All right, we'll take off again on a little bit further aspect of the journey, and something that I guess I had really intended for this afternoon, but earlier. So we're making progress slowly. That's all right. Pilgrims don't care, do they? You see. Jean Houston, who is the author of this Hero and the Goddess, which is an examination of the Odyssey as an experiential journey in myth and mystery. And she's written a number of excellent books, including The Feminine Myth of Creation, Life Force, The Possible Human, Search for the Beloved, and so on. And very interestingly, this is not a Quest book, but she has signed a contract with Quest to be the publisher of her next books. So she's quite an interesting person, I might say. In this, she suggests at one point that if you're asked who what you are and so on, instead of saying you're human, say, I'm a loaded trans-evolutionary species. So remember that. A loaded trans-evolutionary species. And that's to be a pilgrim in movement, trans-evolutionary, you see. It's true, it's very ambiguous and very difficult to be human right now. So it's easier to say, I'm a part of a loaded trans-evolutionary species. You're on the way. So that means we give attention to where we are and what we're about and how we act. What is the behavior, in other words, of the pilgrim? What is the mode of consciousness? We give attention, first of all. It's interesting that the very first text that pointed to the idea of a way, a spiritual path, the first one that was published within the Theosophical context after the actual founding of the Theosophical Society was called Light on the Path, published in 1885, 10 years after the founding of the Society, by M.C., Mabel Collins, of course. It's rather interesting, like we could spend our whole rest of our time on it, but that's the subject of another workshop, actually, on Light on the Path, if you want it. Anyway, that's a whole other subject. But I'd like to look at least the beginning of it. I might just mention that the subtitle of the book, of the work, Light on the Path, which is a small volume, you find it in the bookstore here, of course, the Book Depot, I'm sure, and Ray will be happy to sell you copies and all of the rest. The subtitle is that it's a treatise written for the personal use, which I think immediately makes you aware, the personal use of those who are ignorant of the Eastern wisdom. Now, one has to be very careful because this doesn't necessarily mean the wisdom of India, China, and, you know, the Eastern part of the world, but the Eastern wisdom in terms of that wisdom which derives from the place of light. And in all traditions, the East has been the place of light. The sun rises in the East, so far as we observe. Of course, it doesn't. Earth has moved and so on. But our observations, you see, it's how we give attention, is that it rises there. So the Eastern wisdom is really that wisdom which derives from the place of light, which is the ultimate within us, which is the ultimate in all. And then desire, the subtitle continues, and desire to enter within its influence. So that as pilgrims, where is your Ithaca, as I've said, you see? Where is your paradise? Where is your nirvana? Now, the opening words of the text are very interesting. These rules were written for all disciples. I think it should have said for all pilgrims. But anyway, it says for all disciples, which means that you're in a condition to learn something. And a pilgrim is really in an interior condition to learn something. You're open. You don't know what you're going to learn. You see, it's not like a tourist that you expect to learn the heights of mountains and the depths of lakes and the extent of, you know, how many people live in this country, what they do for a living. You know, these are the things we generally ask now, you see. When you meet somebody, you always ask, what do you do? As though you have to be doing something. What do you do? Which we mean, what do you do for a living? How do you get along? How do you make your money? Is that right? That's what we want to know. What do you do? And then, of course, without really thinking about it, and we don't ask the question quite so bluntly, but we, inside, what we mean by the next question is, well, what are you worth? Now, we don't mean worthy in the sense of the Platonic term. You see, in Plato, you see, something was worthy when it was the good. It was that which one gave from one's being. That was to be worthy. But now, you know, what we mean by what are you worth is, you see, how many houses do you have and how many cars and how much money in your bankroll account and so on, you see. What are you worth? We may not put it just that bluntly, but analyze it. Your question always has to do with, gee, we ought to get that person in the society. They've got a lot of money. Maybe they'd leave it to us, you know, and so on, you see. So what are you worth? Or, well, that person really isn't worth very much, but it's measurable, you see. So anyway, this now comes to, we're in a certain condition in which it said, you see, these rules were written for all disciples. That is, here are rules of the road, if you like. These are the rules of the road for the pilgrim. And so the next sentence, attend you to them. You know, well, if you're going to get a driver's license, you have to know the rules of the road, don't you? Even if you're going to walk somewhere, you better know the rules of the road, you see. So pilgrims need to know the rules of the road. And that's what Light on the Path is all about. But then it indicates, in a sense, the very next paragraph in Light on the Path rather indicates a mode of action, how we conduct ourselves on this journey. It prepares us for the work ahead, and in another sense, it provides us with a glimpse of the outcome of the journey. Because four functions or qualities are referred to in the next paragraph for being pilgrims on this spiritual journey. And it indicates that there are four instruments, if you like, which lead to four functions. And it's very interesting to note this, because it's both that which prepares us for the journey and, in a sense, points to the outcome of the journey. Before the eyes, so the first instrument, the eyes, I think I ruined these with that other board, but maybe you can see it. Before the eyes can see, something must happen. They must be incapable of tears. And then the next is, before the ear can hear, it must have lost its sensitiveness. You have to look at that. Because we have two ears, like we have two eyes. But in the text, before the ear can hear, it. So it's only, it's not one ear, but we'll look at that in a moment. Before the voice can speak, in the presence of the Master, that is, in the presence of the highest we know, in the presence of either that great friend who companions us, or the Master may be that interior soul, that interior spirit, that higher self, if you want to call it that. Before the voice can speak in that presence, it must have lost the power to wound. And then, finally, before the feet can stand in the presence of the Masters again, before the soul, I'm sorry, but I'm going to leave it feet at the moment, the feet must be washed in the blood of the heart. So before the soul can stand, but the instrument is the feet in that sense, do you see? Then the feet must be washed in the blood of the heart in order to be able to stand. Now it's very interesting. We have here, in essence, the ways in which consciousness orients itself to the world in terms of the journey. These are the four modes by which consciousness orientates itself to the world. They're the four functions which Carl Jung defined, mind you, in a great deal of detail. The rational functions of thinking and feeling, and what he called the non-rational functions of intuition and sensation. So I'd like to examine these from the point of view of developing a total consciousness, a total way of working. If we can examine them from the point of view of developing a fully integrated consciousness. Jung suggested, you see, that consciousness orientates itself to the world, to its surroundings, by means of what he called the rational functions of thinking and feeling. These are the reflective functions, if you like, and the non-rational functions of intuition and sensation. And we are seeing these same functions here. We will be looking at that very closely, because these are, you know, we may be the thinking intuitive type. We may be the feeling intuitive type. We may be the feeling sensation type or the thinking sensation type.
Mm-hmm. I don't really see how feeling is irrational.
Feeling, in this sense, it is. Now, let's be very careful, because it really is a rational function. We'll look at that very closely, you see. Now, to be able to see, we'll start with that, to be able to see, the eye has always been the symbol of mental perception, discernment. And in the plural form, it refers, you remember the eyes, in the plural form, to the two aspects of the mind. Psychologically, these two aspects, the two eyes, are symbols of what we can call the ego-self axis, the individuality-personality polarity, centers of personal and transpersonal consciousness, which must be brought into harmony. Here is the thinking function, then, you see, the eyes. Symbolically, the eyes, the thinking function. I think that's very clear, very easy. But, it said, before the eyes can see, they must be incapable of tears. That is to say, does that mean that the mind is to be cold, indifferent? Or does it mean that the thinking function must not ever be so obscured or clouded by personal concern that it distorts true discernment? We have to remove, in other words, all obscuring elements, whether these are emotional reactions, memories, prejudices, and so on. True seeing, we have to become incapable of tears, which does not mean to be without sympathy or compassion, but inwardly immovable. In the Bhagavad Gita, for example, he who is harmonized by yoga, the self-purified, self-ruled, the senses subdued, whose self is the self of all beings, although acting, he is not affected. This is the tranquil mind. In one of the wonderful letters that I've referred to in the correspondence between two of the wise men of this whole philosophy, two of the great adepts, and Mr. Sinnett, one of them wrote that it is upon the serene and placid surface of the unruffled mind that the visions gathered in the invisible find a visible representation. I think I'm quoting it correctly. I don't have it before me. It is on the serene and placid surface of the unruffled mind that the visions gathered in the invisible find their reflection in the visible realm, you see. So when we give attention, when we're focused, we act without rashness or hesitation. Or as the Gita puts it, when as a tortoise draws in on all sides its limbs, he withdraws his senses from the objects of sense, then is his understanding well poised. So this is to be in a condition of true perception. Then the thinking function acts appropriately. And when the thinking function acts appropriately, the inner voice can be heard. So the next step is given as, before the ear can hear, it must have lost its sensitiveness. Now, this is singular, the ear, which is intuition. As I say, we all have two ears, but here it's a single hearing, focused in a single hearing, not the duality of the eyes, which must be brought together, you see. You see, we see, the eyes become focused, which gives depth. If you're without an eye, you may not have depth perception, but they're focused, aren't they, you see. There's a wonderful old sea shanty, you see, about the cook who, with one eye on the stove and one eye on the pot and the other up the chimney, wasn't it? Something like that, yes, you see. The eyes going in two different directions. And symbolically, sometimes our eyes go in two different directions, don't they, you see? We try to. You know, there's one of the wonderful things I could have used is the famous series that are known as the ox herding pictures in China. Sometimes it's a bull, but usually it's called the ox herding pictures. And the first is when he has lost the ox. And the picture is marvelous. Here's this little fellow who's lost the ox, that is, he's lost the way of truth, and his head is pointed one way and his feet are going the other way. You see, this is symbolic of the eyes going in two different directions. We try to see the future while we're looking at the past, you know, that sort of thing. But here it's the ear, the intuitive function. The ear has always been said to be a symbol of an inner receptivity to guidance, the voice of conscience, if you like. And hearing is symbolic of the intuitive perception when one gives attention inwardly. If one is to listen, really listen, and hear the voice of the inner self on this journey, there can be no disturbances, no distractions. The mind must be utterly quiet. This is a loss of sensitiveness, which is not a loss of sensitivity. So notice, as I say, we don't have the plural form. There's the singular form. We have in the first instance then a reference to the dual nature of the mind, but now in the second instance a reference to the singular nature of this buddhic function of listening, the intuitive function. These first two sentences then deal with the clearing of what I can only call an internal state of consciousness, the clearing of the field. Then we can move outward and we can give attention to the external stance that we are to have. So that you can note, for example, that only in the final two sentences is there the phrase, in the presence of the masters. To speak and to stand in that presence means you're in the world and perceive everything as representative of and symbolic of the inner wisdom, the reality that underlies the existence. But to speak and to stand are outer expressions of an inner attitude. They reflect what we are within. You remember Emerson's phrase, what you are speaks so loudly, I cannot hear the words you say. It's a wonderful statement, you see. Now, these two modes of being give us what are called the feeling-sensation axis of our nature. Actually, you said, why are thinking and feeling called the reflective functions? Because feeling is not emotion. Feeling is that sensitiveness of the whole nature, which then begins to color thinking. This is often called the reflective area of our nature. And you cannot separate thinking and feeling. This is why, as many of you know, I say that we flink. You may have heard my word. Actually, we perflink, because it's the whole thing together. We perflink. This is my own word. You may have it if you like. We perceive and feel and think almost simultaneously. There is no thinking with that is not tinged with value judgment. Feeling, from the point of view of the Jungian philosophy, was giving a value. What is worthy? Giving a value to whatever thought arises. We give it a value. So it's not feeling either in the sense of sensation or of emotion. It's the value, that which is worthy, do you see? And so it is all the time.
It's a value.
Yes, so it is all the time operating on our thinking and our thinking on our feeling. So we perflink. We perceive, feel, and think nearly simultaneously. We're perflinking individuals. If you don't like loaded transevolutionary species, just say, well, we're perflinking beings. And this separates us from all the rest of the hierarchies of nature. We perflink, you see. So in this now, we have the feeling, we have the feeling and sensation, which are internal modes. Speech, you see, is the creative function. And so it reenacts the creative process at every moment. Logos, in the beginning was the word. But what does the word do? In the Greek, which is translated in the Gospel of John, the most Gnostic of the Gospels that somehow got into the Bible, and I think it's because those that set of bishops that decided what would go into the what we call the Bible, which is really a cut, you know, a cut and paste job, isn't it? It was bishops. Some bishops decided, well, cut out that and paste in this. You see, it's a cut. I call it a cut and paste job, not irreverently, but that's what it is. And we've discovered a lot of the lost works of the Bible, haven't we? You see, should have gotten in and got left out because these stupid bishops didn't either. They knew that these were going to be dangerous, like the Gospel of Thomas and the Gospel of Philip and the Gospel of Righteousness and all of these that we've now have at our, you know, have finally been translated, that great Nag Hammadi library, wonderful works, you see. But somehow the Gospel of John got in. You know, some little bishop in the back row said, I like the Gospel of John. Can we have it, please? You know, I could just see that council. And they thought, well, we better keep this little fellow quiet, and so let's put it in. You know, nobody will know what it really means anyhow, you see. And that's true. People have struggled with the Gospel of John ever since. Isn't that right? In the beginning was the Word. Is that what it says? No, it doesn't say that. It says, for the sake of a beginning, for the sake of a newness, Logos was present. Logos is order, the ordering principle. That's what Logos is, often translated as the Word. But what does the Word do? A word brings into order all ideas, gives order to them, you see. Even when it is a spoken word, the word itself, you see, well, you can look at it from point of view of vowels and consonants, you see. In the beginning was the, if you like, in the beginning, we might as well have a beginning, why not? Was the chaos, the great gap, the yawning, which is what chaos really means, is to yawn. It was a yawning gulf, you see. If you yawn, that's chaos. Not disorder, but pre-order, in which arises then order by articulation. If you just have there is no meaning, but it's articulation through the instruments of articulation. You see the vocal cords and the tongue, the lips, the dentals, the nasal cavity, all of that gives articulation, which gives order. Isn't it, you see? So, and God said, let there be light. Because the very saying, the very expression brought about a new condition. Not that light, you see, light limited chaos. Light limited what could be seen. Darkness is unlimited. Light begins to limit it, doesn't it? So you have a cosmos. And what is cosmos? Cosmos is an appearance, an illusion, maya. It's the same word we have in cosmetic. Do you know that? It's the very same basis. And what do cosmetics do? They think, well, we think they give us a nice appearance, lipstick and so on. You see, and I'm ready for the day. Is that right? You see? Brush my hair. This is all cosmetic, you see. What was your mask? It was cosmetic. Gave you an appearance, you see. So maya is not so much illusion as that which produces an appearance. And that's what cosmos is. The cosmos is an appearance, which is only an approximation of the ultimately real. And so it is by speaking that we bring this forth, you see. And so speech is this creative function, and it reenacts the creative moment, creative process at every moment. But it must be without the power to wound. So this is the speaking. This is the ordering, which gives value, gives meaning. So it's the voice. I guess I shouldn't put speaking there. I'm sorry. Where's my eraser? It's the voice. You see. And so now it's that creative function, which feeling genuinely is creative, which moves the mind as we, if you want to, come among us. Are you more comfortable calling it come among us? Some people are. Yeah, I don't care what you call it. Thinking, feeling, or come among us. You know, call it what you like. Some people like the Sanskrit, and other people say, why do we have to have any Sanskrit? You know, well, it's interesting. I won't get into that debate. So, it must be without the power to wound, however. The voice must be without the power to wound. That is to say that the sort of the emotions must be cleaned up. Karma must not be destroyed, but it sort of must be cleaned up of all impurities. Psychic energy is not to be dammed up, but to be used. Speech must become a blessing, not a curse. The power of the word must be used for creative purposes. So it is creative, it's also destructive, isn't it? You see. But we have to learn to use it. It must have lost the power to wound, because it must be cleansed. So the word, how do we speak as pilgrims? How do we tell our stories to each other around the fires at night, you know? That's when you tell good stories, isn't it? Around the fire, the campfire at night. You know, that's when you have wonderful stories, isn't that right? Didn't you, any of you in your youth have bonfires or campfires and tell stories and so on, you see? And how do we tell our stories around? This is, of course, the ancient myths. They were told, they were recited. You didn't read them in books, you heard them, you see. And they were told with a fascination, you know, the ancient storytellers. And then to stand is, here are the feet. To stand in the presence of the masters, the feet must be washed in the blood of the heart. To stand is symbolic then of the sensation function, the immediate apperception of the circumstances of existence. The feet represent physical existence. So only when the personality is brought into a proper condition, which often means, of course, having the feet washed in the blood of the heart, can the senses, as the instruments of sensation, give us correct information. So the feet are also representative of understanding. To really be able to stand means to be firm in the world, to be planted in the world, to walk the world. How do we walk the world? With that great understanding that which comes from, of course, in a sense, being washed in the blood of the heart. Suffering, that is to bear under, which is the meaning of suffer, to bear under all that it means to be human. All that it means to you see, to be a god, one has to be human. To really be a true god, one has to be a human. And so we become the saviors of God. So our mode of conduct in the world, our behavior as pilgrims, involves this fourfold functioning of consciousness. No one aspect of our nature can be neglected. And the symbols that are used remind us that it is here and now, in physical incarnation, that our ultimate achievement is to take place. We begin our journey. And so that little paragraph, as I say, suggests both the necessity of the work that is before us as pilgrims, and in a sense a glimpse of the outcome of the totality of our being. And so I've put it in Jungian terms because I think it fits so very beautifully and helps us to see that we have to orientate consciousness in all these dimensions and directions. So we can begin to perhaps reprogram some of our attitudes, but there isn't really time to suggest that. I might start tomorrow with that, we will see. There are other ways, of course, in which one can begin to look at the mode of conduct. The conduct, these are given also in the voice of the silence as the paramitas, but I'm not going to go into that, but the voice of the silence of HPB, her last great work, her gift, last final gift to the world, also gives a mode of conduct known as the paramitas, the modes of acting in the world according to the transcendental nature of our being. The paramitas, we won't go into those. However, I want to take this final time, and I'm going to ask Hugh to come up and find out if there are questions or comments or what you think about so far. And I'll ask Hugh to sort of govern that.
This is so that everybody puts their hands up, you know, at the same time, I'll be able to pick whose turn it is.
Yes. All right, it's your chance to say something.
I'd like to go over the diagram again to clarify the relation of the physical description of the instrument to the function, to the intuition, thinking, feeling, and sensation. But
these are, Jung calls this axis the non-rational, not irrational, mind you, but non-rational. That is, they arise spontaneously. It's an axis in which there is not present the thinking, feeling mind, but it has to pass through the reflective area. Notice. You see. So I refer you to some basic Jungian psychology in that helps to really begin to see that is true, that it is non-rational, and you see, in a sense, the hearing that is spoken of, the ear, you see, must hear in that way, must indeed have this, shall I say, it's before the ear can hear, it must have lost its sensitiveness. It has to do with a voice that is heard that is does not arise in the realm of thinking, feeling. And the sensation that is referred to is that, what Jung means by sensation, is that one is grounded. One is grounded. The feet, there's an understanding which is with the totality of one's being. One acts from that, which is, as I say, it's not irrational, but it's not rational. It's not rooted in the realm of rationality.
I think Bob, next, if you wouldn't mind standing up for people with the questions.
I find listening to you is no thoughts at all. There's no thoughts in relation to what I know. Listening to you completely, I can communicate with you and learn. If I'm questioning using my own, what I think I know, I can't learn. That's slightly different.
Mm-hmm. Well? Don't you, this is only a diagram, remember. Diagrams are maps that are useful. But remember, the map is not the territory, which is the famous phrase in general semantics. The map is not the territory. You know, you can get out a map and see that there is a road from Auckland to, where do roads go here? Down to Wellington, I guess?
Tauramanui.
Yes. There's a road. And you can look at that and say, oh yes, we go that way and this way, and there's a few squiggles, I expect, on the map. Lots of squiggles, and but it's very different to drive the road, isn't it? Mm-hmm. When you drive the road, see all sorts of things that weren't ever on the map at all.
I think, was it Murray somebody in the second row here put their hand up earlier? Forget which one it was. It was die.
Die.
So the word intuition, does it create there as inner teaching?
Yes.
And therefore, the inner teaching relates to what a lot of people call the still small voice.
The still small voice, conscience, that says and
And then we almost do so in our hero.
That's right, we do.
Anybody else with a question or a comment? Jocelyn.
There are catamounts.
Yes.
If we literally counsel and evolve
What then? You see, we all want to know the goal. We all, you know, if we really unite with God, says Jocelyn, you see, if we give God purpose and God gives us purpose, and there we are, you see, we've returned, as it were, full cycle. What then? I don't know. I don't know. I haven't been there yet. And that's the glory of it, you see. This is the new frontier. This is the frontier of inner space. I haven't been there. So, but we all want to know this, don't we? We want to be sure of the goal. We want to know that, where is it we're traveling to from Auckland?
Taramanui.
Taramanui. We want to know that Taramanui is there, so to speak. Well, supposing it isn't there when you get there. Supposing it's, you know, this is the thing that's very interesting. To be prepared for that leap into the unknown. This is what Krishnamurti talked about a very great deal, isn't it? It's a leap into the unknown. It's a willingness, you see. We like the known. We like the feeling that it's going to be just an extension of what we already know. Is it going, you know, or that it's going to be different in some sense, you see. Is it, you know, is Sydney going to be different than Auckland? Let's put it that way, you see. Or is it going to be the same, just another city? Or is it going to be somewhat different? You see, Odysseus didn't really know where he was going when he got tossed around on the seas. And he'd land on one island, the island of Calypso and the island of Circe and the Phaeacians and so on, you see. This was a new experience. I think it's marvelous. Pilgrims are really not sure what they're going to find at the end. Even in the Canterbury Tales, they were headed for Canterbury, you see. Did they get there? In the Grail Quest, you see. When they got there, what was there, you see? So it's a frontier that's frontierless. It's a path that is pathless.
Hubert has a question.
Hubert.
Yes, that last comment about searching for God, but surely God is evolving in the same way as we are.
That's...
Therefore, we will never mind what God is about moving ourselves and experiencing it.
That's what it's been suggested, that we grow the gods within us, and we have to allow the gods their growth. Yes, and they took, you know, the phrase originally came from Nietzsche, you see, and they took Nietzsche rather literally, but that isn't really what Nietzsche said, if you examine Nietzsche fully. I'm not going to go into a lecture on Nietzsche, but it's rather interesting. What he was talking about is that the God that had in one sense been the paradigm for that age was gone, was over with. Now, many people took it that, you see, the existentialists picked this up very much. Jean-Paul Sartre, and even Kierkegaard, father of existentialism and so on, picked it up and said, you know, we don't need any spirituality. We don't need anything of the sacred. God is dead, you know, forget about it. This is a new age. What matters is this moment, this very moment. And so we denied ourselves a whole dimension of experience. And so that's why I think we have to resacralize the world, nirvanize the world, but resacralize the world. And we're realizing that, I think, in contemporary times, that the very fact that some of these old myths have arisen to haunt us, Gaia, the whole concept that the earth is a living, breathing, pulsating being. Gaia, the whole Gaia concept, hypothesis. And that, you know, we've exploited this planet long enough. We've raped the planet. We've cut down the forests and extracted the resources from the ground. And, you know, we've done all of these things that we could be as rapacious as possible with our planet. that now we're realizing we have really, that God is not dead, that we have really slaughtered the God, and we have to now revive the God.
I think if you're going to affirm something anyway, you have to look at it in some sense so that it doesn't exist. You know, if you take something and you say it exists, then you have to look at the possibilities of it not existing in order to affirm it that in actual fact it does exist.
That's one way of doing it. Logos is synonymous with order. We translate logos as word, but actually it had to do with that calling into being of an ordered universe.
So you're indicating that this sort of mistranslation?
Not fully, but it's been translated as word, which is all right. But it underneath that is this deeper meaning that it's order. And it's interesting that science today, you know, is acknowledging, many physicists are acknowledging that we live in an ordered universe. And it's meaningful, and therefore can be understood, that it's a rational universe. Therefore it can be understood. If the universe were not rational, it couldn't be understood. But it is rational. It is ordered and orderly. So it can be understood. Therefore, the laws which govern it operate everywhere equally, not in some places and not in others, which would be an irrational universe.
Hubert?
Just on that comment, Stephen Hawking has suggested that there is a chaotic state, although it's rational within the limits, but in a macrocosm and a microcosm, it is totally chaotic.
But what does he mean? The whole science of fractals shows that even within chaos, there is order. Yes, there is pattern. Yes, there is pattern, you see. And the whole science of fractals has come about through the computer, which is marvelous. I really don't understand it because I'm no mathematician. I can't even keep, well, I do keep my bank balance, but barely. But beyond that, mathematics stumps me. But here is a whole science, the science of chaos, that within it, which has been discovered through the computer, through fractals, that there is a pattern, even in the very, in what appears to be chaotic.
Could one say to bring order in chaos, really, that means more light into darkness?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And order, mm-hmm.
That's right. That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Light into, you see. And it's not that light reveals so much, but it limits us to so much less.
Charles?
Yes. The
word, in the beginning was the word. Mm-hmm. The word is a sound. Which is vibration.
Yes, right.
And if we go back to the secret doctrine, it says that when the point of manifestation occurred, mm-hmm. there was a vibration in the wall of darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why the sound was in the beginning.
That's right, yes. You're absolutely right, Charles. Thank you for bringing that up, because it is a vibration which automatically brings order, too. It reveals the orderliness there. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Carmen?
I'm just fascinated by this order of chaos. It's as if we started off with chaos, therefore it sounds like there was a beginning.
Well.
But it also, therefore, sounds like it could be an end. You know, I don't see.
No, no. It's, yes, as the secret doctrine puts it, the system is without conceivable beginning or imaginable end, but it's cyclic. It's cyclic, you see. So, you know, Martin Buber, the great Jewish theologian, said that even at the outset in the Hebrew scripture, it should not have been translated in the beginning, but for the sake of a beginning. which is a wonderful way of looking at it.
Goodness me, how I know you so well and your name's gone out of my head.
That's why I had you up here.
Sorry.
Yes.
From the unmanifest, we get pairs of opposites. Because it seems to me, the more I've been looking at this question, that everything in manifestation is a matter of pairs of opposites.
Is it a pair?
Everything we deal with in the personal sense and the transpersonal sense in a special way is pairs of opposites. And we have order and chaos. And from the unmanifest, we can only have manifestation if we have what to us appears chaos and appears orderliness or intelligence or vibration. And Jinarajadasa, in speaking about the meaning of logos, which he speaks of, I think, in First Principles of Theosophy, he brings in the element of intelligence as being part of the true meaning.
Oh, yes. Yes.
So you have an intelligent ordering principle at the same time as you have what to us, for the sake of a word, is chaos. Otherwise, nothing could be manifest.
That's yes. That's very true. And it's, you see, this moving to this idea, some scientists, Paul Davies and some others, are beginning to, well, certainly Dr. David Bohm did very much, moving to this idea that consciousness is present. Dr. Brian Swim, who is a cosmologist in the United States, and there's a wonderful series of videos that he did on the story of creation, absolutely marvelous work, suggests that within that moment prior to the Big Bang, if consciousness had not been present, in seed, in essence, it could never have manifested at any stage afterwards, because nothing was added to. And that's a marvelous idea. And of course, theosophically, intelligence came first. We would accept that.
In many instances, but life is consciousness.
That's right.
Consciousness.
But I am no longer content with the words, the pairs of opposites, because there is a polarization that occurs. We perceive these as opposites, but it's a polarization in which there are marks on this continuum. Perhaps the easiest example is cold the opposite of hot? Or is it on a continuum of temperature in which cold and hot are varying degrees? So there's a continuum of vibration, to come back to what Charles said. It's a continuum of vibration in which there is the rhythmic ups and downs, if you like, the cycles. But it's polarities that we see. And this Dante makes very clear in the Purgatorio, in which each of the know that I can point to it at once, but each of the vices, you see, is now has there its polarized opposite, as it were. It's a matter of polarity, which comes about, and it's the souls of the prodigal, and the prodigality is matched by what we would call its opposite, but the polar, but both have to be present, he points out, and I can't point to the exact, I thought I could point to the exact phrase that he has, but again and again he points out that at the various levels of the purgatorio that there is this continuum which we call virtue and vice, but the virtues are also inherently have within them the vices, the vices have inherently within them the virtues.
Both have to be present or neither.
That's right. That's right.
What really means that all those, the opposites are not really opposites, they're just progressions of the same thing.
That's right, of the same thing.
Everything's being what it is.
Yes, that's right. The trick is in the balance. This is why, you know, you cross the bridge on a reed, or it's a razor-edged path. You cross the bridge on the edge of a sword. I think it does. I think faith is very necessary. Of course, faith is very necessary. True faith. You know, it's interesting. In the Buddhist tradition, you see, faith is absolutely required. It's called shraddha. Marvelous term, shraddha, which means having confidence. And at the feet of the master, this is translated as confidence, which is with faith. The word confidence, with faith. That's what it means, doesn't it? Con, with, and fides, faith, you see. And so it's translated there as confidence. Confidence in the teacher. And this, from the Buddhist point of view, you have to have confidence in the teacher. You have to, I remember Rinpoche, who did a series at our world headquarters at Adyar, saying, it's as though you went into the bazaar seeking a piece of silk, and you went from stall to stall, and you sampled, you felt the silk. And then you had confidence that the piece you selected was the best that could be selected. You had confidence, you had faith, you see. And you had, just so do you select the teacher, which may not be a person, it may be a teaching, but you select the teacher, you test them. You test it, as you would test a piece of silk in the bazaar. I thought it was a wonderful analogy to have.
And courage.
And courage, of course, courage. A bravery of the soul, as I put it. A real bravery of the soul is called for. That we say our human life has a beginning and end. We say this is one incarnation, for example. One has to really look at that very closely. Because every moment there's a little death and a rebirth. And is there, you see, if you accept the idea that we're more than the physical, but even if you confine it to the physical, is there a real end? Is there a final, complete end? It appears so. It appears so. But look at it very, very closely. We don't probe this, you see. For example, what is it that reincarnates? We could go on about that for a long, long time. What is it? We'd be here all night. Yes.
Yeah.
What
dies
becomes something else. So where does it end and where does it begin? Where did this life begin and where does it end? I mean, true, Joy Mills may not be around anymore, but will Joy Mills be around? Perhaps in some other way. I'll come back and haunt you.
Could be in a parallel universe. That's another subject.
Yes, it's quite another subject.
We'd like to thank Joy very much for this 1/3 of the complete weekend already gone. We've still got 2/3 to go, and we look forward to it very much.